listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
This is to all the children. May your kids bring you as much joy as you've brought us. Seriously, just go to sleep. The cats nestle close to their kittens. The lambs have lain down with the sheep. You're cozy and warm in your bed, my dear. Please, just this once, go to sleep. The windows are dark in the town, child. The whales huddled down in the deep. I'll read you one very last book if you swear you'll close your eyes and sleep. The eagles who soar through the sky are at rest, and the creatures who crawl, run, and creep. I know you're not thirsty. You just had a drink. Stop goofing around now and sleep. The wind whispers soft through the grass, hun. The field mice, they make not a peep. It's been 38 minutes already. Remember, we made a deal. Sleep! All the kids from preschool are in dreamland. The froggy has made his last leap. No way, you can't go to the bathroom. Guess where you can go, my darling? To sleep. The owls fly forth from the treetops. Through the air they soar and they sweep. A weariness pounds through my head, love, for real. No more talking. Let's sleep. The cubs and the lions are snoring, wrapped in a big, snuggly heap. You're incredibly cute and super-duper smart, but why is it so hard to just sleep?
I feel like I want to show you the pictures like I'm reading to kids.
The seeds slumber beneath the earth now, and the crops that the farmers will reap. No more questions. This interview's over. I've got three words for you, kid. Go to sleep. The tiger reclines in the simmering jungle. The sparrow has silenced her cheep. What do you want now? Another stuffed bear? Four's plenty. Lie back down and sleep. The flowers doze low in the meadows and high on the mountains, so steep. My life is absurd. This is taking forever. Stop messing with me, please, and sleep. The giant pangolins of Madagascar are snoozing as I lie here and try not to weep. Sure, fine, whatever. I'll bring you some milk. You're obviously not gonna sleep. This room is all I can remember. The furniture, flimsy and cheap. You win. You escape. You run down the hall as my chin hits my chest and I sleep. Bleary and dazed, I awaken to find your eyes shut, so I keep my fingers crossed tight as I tiptoe away and pray that you're really asleep. We're finally watching our movie. Popcorn's in the microwave. Beep! No way! Don't believe it. You've got to be kidding. All right, well, let's go back to sleep.
Everybody for being here. I know,
yeah.
Right?
It's really hard not to say the other
thing. Yeah. I can't. Yeah, me too.
Well, okay, I have to start here. I'm not crazy. That was Sam Jackson making a cameo at the end of this book. And I don't know of a better way to start to talk about how this book has kind of captured a kind of zeitgeist. I mean, it's really become a part of the culture. What is this a shock to you? Was this what you anticipated? I mean, having Sam Jackson in your orb now is kind of really cool. Were you surprised by the reaction to the book?
Oh, hell yes. Yeah. I mean, this book started very whimsically without any expectations of any kind. I staggered out of my daughter Vivian's room one night after 2 hours in there and jokingly posted on Facebook, "Be on the lookout for my forthcoming children's book, Go the Fuck to Sleep." And, you know, I had no intention of writing it. I was just blowing off steam. But as soon as I wrote that, I realized that I knew what that book would look like and sound like, and I knew that Ricardo would be the man to make it look the way I saw it look. So I had no intention even of publishing it at that time.
Right, right.
So it was something that sort of proceeded very slowly.
I was going to ask, what's the gap between posting that on Facebook and actually sitting down to create it on paper?
About 2 weeks.
That's not that long.
Yeah.
That's not that long.
I mean, when I sat down and did it, it was quick. It took me like an afternoon or something.
And so you said you already had Ricardo in mind. Before we even get to how he kind of got involved in it, how do you guys know each other? I mean, why did he first pop into your mind?
How many likes did you get on that post?
Like, not that many, really. You know, like 15. Like, yeah, ha ha, you know. I mean, it wasn't, I think there's some, people have heard the story that I posted that on Facebook, and I think there's some sense that there was some groundswell of support, and I had to write the book because so many people responded. Nah, my friends were like, yeah, whatever, motherfucker, you know. Like, it wasn't like, it was just my own sense that I knew what the book would be. But yeah, Ricardo and I go back to high school. I'll let Ricardo talk about it.
We grew up outside of Boston.
Were you in Cross Colors? Tell the truth.
Sure. All day. Yeah. I'm not ashamed of that. I wish I still had my Cross Colors hat.
I had my Pelly. And it was like a punk rock type more venue. And we met up, and there was like a punk band. It was the house band. And it was scorching sun. And by the end of the day, they had broken the drum sticks.
Right.
Right.
First, the record started melting in the sun, so the punk rock drummer had to come up and play for all the rappers.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, punk rock and rap, they didn't mix that much. Everybody thought rappers were, like, not musicians. So it was the first, I think it was historic in a lot of ways.
This was before Anthrax and Public Enemy got together.
Right. And also, I think Go the Fuck to Sleep really represents a bridging of the historical Newton South, Newton North rivalry that's... Can't be emphasized how important that is.
Either. Yeah, and so we knew that each other then. We were at undergrad together as well. Adam started a hip hop magazine and enlisted me as the art director. Although at the time I didn't know Photoshop, I didn't know any of the graphic design tools. So it was pretty much giving him some of my drawings that had nothing to do with the articles that were being illustrated. But he just liked my portfolio, and so there'd be an illustration of Bob Marley next to an article about jazz.
Yeah.
Did you study the visual arts in school, or?
No, I didn't. I've just been drawing. Since I was a little kid, I was always drawing. So no formal training.
Okay, and so one day, a couple of years ago, you get a phone call.
Yeah, so
Adam.
Yeah, I don't even remember how it first came, but I think you just, did you send me it as a,
I think I sent you the poem. I wrote the poem. The book was more or less in its finished form. Some editing was still to be done, but it was fairly intact as what it now exists as. And I think I sent it to you and said, do you feel like doing a couple of sample illustrations so that we could take this and show it to a publisher?
So you had arrived at a point where this belongs to the world.
At that
I can't
point,
hold on to it.
Yeah, it wasn't quite that dramatic, but yeah, I'd gotten to a point where I was like, I don't know, maybe I should try to publish this shit. I am a writer.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I'd at least gotten to that point.
Yeah.
And I sent it to Ricardo, and he was into it.
Yeah. Okay. So at first it was a poem. It was more of a poem. It didn't quite have the actual. This is a narrative. It has an ending mm-hmm. that kind of wraps it up. And at first it was when it came to me just as "Go the Fuck to Sleep." It was a poem, but I understood it immediately. I thought it just hit it right on the head. I thought it would be really funny. I thought people would be talking about it. Neither of us, I think, thought that it would really catch the way that it did. It was funny. It was somewhat provocative, but it wasn't crass. I never thought of this book as crass, even though it's full of this language. But it felt loving, and I understood the sentiment behind it, and that was important because I didn't feel it was like exploiting the situation. It was just it was heartfelt.
It is heartfelt. It's very heartfelt.
So we put together like three or four illustrations and sent it to a friend of ours who Adam had worked. We had both worked a little bit together with. Adam had worked on a book with before. Mm-hmm.
So what's it like for you, Adam? You're an award-winning literary author. What is it like to now be known in some circles as a children's book author? And how does that disrupt or add to your sense of yourself or your career, yourself as a writer?
I'll take it, I mean, yeah, I'm a literary writer. I spent 10 years writing novels, like an asshole. Only to realize that the real money and fame is in obscene fake children's literature.
Okay. All right.
I wish I'd known that.
Does anybody have
out
a pen?
Grad
I'm
going to
write that down.
Yeah. No, it's great. I will continue to do the work.
Yeah.
The one through line in my career, I guess, is that I've always, for better or for worse, written the books I felt like writing without really any thought or any expectation about market forces and how they would ramify.
And there seems to be a through line of being provocative. I mean, that seems to be, even under the umbrella of doing a children's book, it still has a very particular voice, and it's provocative. I mean, it stokes up from tight. I mean, the title of all of your books, like, stokes something before you even open to page one. And so that seems to be kind of a through line.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, I am a believer in the power of literature and the importance of it, and I think related to that is the notion that one should not take the time to write a book. As you know, it's not something that can be done quickly unless you're writing a 400-word book such as this. You know, it takes time, and I can't see why you would take that much time and expend that much energy unless you really deeply believed in what you were doing. My books tend to deal with things like identity and race and human complexity mm-hmm. and paradox. In this case, the paradox is very simple. It's the paradox that you can simultaneously love your kid and be willing to do absolutely anything to get out of that room after 2 hours. Like if Don Corleone walked in the room and was like, I'll put the kid to bed, but you have to do a service for me one day. This day may never come. Yeah, whatever, Don Corleone. Like, take this fucking baby, that's a simple paradox, but I think in some sense, yeah, this is in line with my other work in that I tend to gravitate toward dealing with difficult truths, maybe,
Right. Well, that's a perfect segue to kind of talk about some of the difficult truths about parenting and some things that I think are very peculiar to our generation in terms of how we approach. First of all, I'm just curious because I have, as my daughter says, a potty mouth. Do you curse in front of your kid?
I guess she's talking to me because you don't have to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you just tell her?
No, I try very hard not to. I'm not always successful, but I in theory, no.
I'm just curious. I'm terrible about it. That's one place where I fail as a mother completely and totally. So, right? So what do you think it is about our generation, or do you think it's just our generation that's engaged in this kind of great sleep debate about parenting? Hmm. Do you think that other people in the 50s were sitting around over coffee talking about how to get their kid to go to sleep? What's the best way? Debating, judging each other, competing with one another? Is it harder now, or what is? Why are we so weird about all of it?
Well, I mean, my memories of the 50s are spotty at best. I think that it was probably always difficult. I think culturally it's more acceptable to bitch and moan about how hard it is.
That's a good point.
I think there was a certain stoicism. Although I think that one of the reasons this book has had the impact it's had is because there's still a culture of silence around the more difficult aspects of parenting. People are trapped in their own little bubbles with their problems. And we don't, as, you know, as many forums as there are to discuss every aspect of parenting, there's a way in which many parents feel that they are being judged or that they will be if they express the frustration, the anxiety. So there's a strange culture of oversharing that's paradoxically coupled with an inability to really be truly honest about some of the deeper frustrations.
Well, I mean, part of the problem, I think, is, you know, at least in terms of however plugged in you are to the media, I mean, one week you're chastising somebody who's popping. I hear, why do I need to know that January Jones ate her placenta? Like, why do I know that? But she did, like in pill form. Why do I know that Alicia Silverstone was chewing the food in her kid's mouth and putting it, chewing it first and then putting it in her kid's, like, we're, there's this whole...
For the record, I was unaware of
it. You were unaware of both of them.
I'm not
so
sure
then
I
it's
know who
just
January
me
Jones
that
is.
I am on TMZ and I know all this stuff. But there is this kind of culture of competitiveness and almost... you said the word stoicism, but there's almost this sense of, like, everybody proving, like, how much they can take and not saying the parts of it that really suck. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, without looking like you're some kind of a monster if you say there are parts of this that suck, that are really bad. Mm-hmm. And, no, I mean, when my daughter came home with the whole crying thing and the sleeping thing, I was like, oh, I actually just died. Like, I had a good run. I had 30 good years, and now it's that's it. I have no life anymore. I mean, I really felt like something had been kind of ripped away from me, and I didn't know who to talk to about it. So I can completely, completely understand. Well, what...
And I also noticed when you were talking about how your failure as a mother to yeah. not curse, you seemed a little sheepish, a little embarrassed about that.
I am. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's actually now...
This is very therapeutic then.
This is very therapeutic then for me. I mean, I basically have just told her, this is where I don't get it right, so don't mm-hmm. do what I do. I mean, I you know, listen to me about everything else, but don't... And she's, for the most part, never really done it. One time, something fell out of a closet, and she said, that scared the fuck out of me. And I was like, oh, no. Mm. No, we can't. Once it comes, you think it's not that big of a deal, but when you hear a three-year-old...
Yeah, no, it's not cute.
It is not cute. Yeah. It's not cute at all. It's not good. Anyway, what was, dear Adam, what was your sleep training experience like? And why were you in there for 2 hours?
Well, you know... My daughter Vivian, who I love dearly, my theory is simply that she's a very smart, very alert child who, when it came time to go to sleep, could not cause her brain to kind of spin down on command.
Right.
So it wasn't that she was hysterical. It wasn't that she was crying and screaming and carrying on. She was just very pleasantly reviewing the day and, you know, things would just float to the surface and... Sometimes she would wonder how people that we hadn't seen for 6 months were doing and, you know, things like that. We didn't do, I think neither my partner nor I had really the heart to do the real hardcore by the book sleep training thing where there's, as you say, there's the great debate, there's attachment parenting and I don't know what the opposite of attachment parenting is. I don't care about my child parenting or something. I don't know.
When you say it like that.
No, I'm just kidding. one of the most amazing things about this entire go the fuck to sleep run was my encounter with Dr. Ferber.
You had an actual encounter with
no, me and
the
Ferber,
actual human being?
Goddamn right, yeah.
No, but like it was volatile?
No, it was amazing. So it was in LA. Dr. Ferber, one of the strange things, I don't know if this happens.
Do people know who Ferber is? The lock him in a room and walk away.
Yeah, he's like the guru of the...
That's harsh.
Yeah.
No, but that doesn't work. The going back in does not work. If you want to get your ass kicked, go back in after 5 minutes. That shit doesn't work.
He wrote a book called The Ferber Method, which is like how to get your kid to sleep. And he's controversial. He's either wildly esteemed or demonized.
He says that the kids basically kind of have to navigate that on their own. There's no one who can help them go to sleep. That you just have to leave them in a room and let them figure it out. And people call it the crying it out method.
Right.
And the reverse of that is they're in your bed till they're 15.
Right.
It's the opposite. Anyway. Yeah.
Right. My daughter goes to a Waldorf school, so she'll be also learning to read around 15.
Yes,
so,
yes.
One of the things that happens to me sometimes, bizarrely, is that people think that I'm some kind of, you know, sleep expert or something. I don't know where they get this idea from. But Dr. Ferber and I were asked to kind of be the celebrity hosts of a fundraiser Los Angeles for the Boston Children's Hospital. Yeah. He's also a Boston guy. So my job was just to, like, get drunk and shake people's hands, and they were giving away the book. Dr. Ferber gave an entire presentation, like a slideshow. And this was at a hotel here in L.A., and, you know, nobody attending this fundraiser had ever put a child to bed because, like, their nannies do that, you know? They just wanted to drink, and maybe they were going to write a check, maybe they weren't, whatever. But he kind of, like, he did this whole lengthy slideshow, and there were, like, charts and graphs, and he used illustrations from our book to show what one should not do, you know?
Oh.
Like, here you see the parent sneaking out of the room. You should never do that. And I was like, great, I'm being thrown under the bus by Dr. Richard Ferber. That's fantastic. But he was a very nice guy, and, you know, we chatted beforehand. And then, and this is where the story, to me anyway, gets amazing, is the following morning I get an email from Dr. Ferber. And Dr. Ferber says, why didn't you tell me that I know you? Dr. Ferber's lost his fucking mind, you know? So it turns out that I went to summer camp with Dr. Ferber's son, Thad, the unfortunately named Thad Ferber. And, you know, it's, you know, you have, as a kid, you know, you have those friends from summer camp, and they live three towns over, and you see them once a year in the year. So Thad Ferber and I are our one outing outside of summer camp, which I got thrown out of eventually. Unrelated incident. We went to Tower Records on Newberry Street in Boston, which is where you went to buy, you know, hip-hop 12 inches and stuff. As Ricardo said, you know, we were both, Ricardo and I, not Thad Ferber, we're hip-hop kids. I was a DJ, I was a rapper, all that. So this is like 1990. So we go into Tower Records, and there's a life-sized cardboard cutout of MC Hammer.
Oh, no.
Who was a controversial figure, you know. As a hip-hopper, he was the enemy. He was infiltrating and watering down the music. So naturally, I ripped the head off of the cardboard cutout, put it in my jacket, and attempted to escape from Tower Records, which was unsuccessful. I was grabbed by Tower Records security, taken into the dungeon below Tower Records. Thad Ferber, by association, was taken down with me.
Oh,
and, you know, and they said, you know, we're going to call the cops and your parents and this and that. And, you know, I'd been in trouble before. So I gave them like a fake phone number, you know, and the phone rang and rang, and Thad Ferber gave him his real phone number. So Dr. Ferber showed up and took us home, and I guess he told his son where he was, and Thad had reminded him that I was that kid. And the whole thing made me feel much better, because I, you know, like, even Dr. Ferber is not perfect as a parent in that he let his kid hang out with me.
Right.
You know?
Exactly. So. Now, what sleep method did your parents use? What sleep method did your parents use? So maybe this is an example of we should go in the opposite direction.
You know, apparently I slept fine as a kid. That's the only thing I get any credit for as a kid, my ability to fall asleep.
Well, while we're on the topic of people's reactions to it and all of this, I thought I read somewhere that there was in some quarters backlash to the book, or people that feel like you're being inappropriate, I guess, or what form does the backlash take, and how do you react to it?
You know, I don't really react to it, because, I mean, I think whenever somebody has piped up with a complaint, the fans of the book have handled it for us. You know, like, I don't know, there's been like, I would never read this book to a child. Like, yeah, no kidding, you know, like, it says fuck on the cover.
Right.
And on the back it says, you should not read this book to a child. So it would take a strange blend of literacy and illiteracy.
Right,
seems
right.
to me to mistakenly read this book to a child. So, I don't know, that's been part of it. There was a censorship effort in New Zealand. I don't know why that would be. I thought they were pretty libertarian down there.
I think you should become a sleep expert. This is delightful. I mean,
am I boring you to sleep?
No, but I think that you said neither you or your partner wanted to do, because the thing, there is, in my experience, one person in the family has to be a badass about it. Like, somebody has to. And I think why people are drawn to just go the fuck to sleep is that we can imagine that you're that badass that's going to, like, I don't know, help us. I don't know.
Yeah, that would be good.
My mother would sneak out of the room, and she told me that she would literally, like, she would leave her foot in the corner of the room and just kind of wait there, like her toe would be sticking inside. And as soon as her foot would leave, I'd start crying, and she'd have to sneak her foot back in. I was not a good sleeper.
Well, this is perfect to bring you back in. I'm curious how, Ricardo, you approached these, or did you approach these illustrations differently than the book on weed or the book on other subject matter?
Yeah, well, when Adam came with the story, we had one phone conversation where we pretty much mapped out the entire structure of the story, and I had, you know, planned in beforehand. I'm going to talk to Adam today at 2 o'clock, so I'd already thought about what I wanted to say, and as soon as I explained my vision about it, it was pretty much exactly what Adam had thought as well, which was that I wanted to be straight across with all these illustrations. I didn't want it to be jokey, because the book, Adam had already kind of nailed that, and my job was to just support those words. And I see it as an homage to classic children's literature with the idyllic landscapes and serenity and, you know, a couple teddy bears and things like that. So so I got to exercise these saccharine sweet scenes, but I knew that they were, you know, being made
undercut.
Undercut and and made readable by Adam's words, you know. So
does that open something up in you as an artist to know that you could kind of go to a place that may be a sweet place that you don't necessarily.
It was fun to just play with that genre and not have to worry about that I was being corny. And, you know, now the irony is that when we did this book, you know, because the original book was a parody, a satire of children's literature. And if you've seen the book, it's this big, and then we had the opportunity to do an actual children's book.
Right.
So,
and the art is different between the two books. There are gradation. I mean, I noticed, you know, changes.
There are changes. I mean, a great part of it was that I thought, well, this book is actually for children. This new book is for kids. And so I want to have fun with that. I want the kids that are going to be reading it to get lost in the worlds that, you know, that I would get lost in myself as a child. So there's little Easter eggs, and there's changes, and also being aware that there's a vast audience that are very familiar with the original book, and so want to give them something to play with too. And yeah, so there was a balance between some things were for the kids. Samuel Jackson, obviously, not, kids don't really know who that is. But that was just fun, you know.
Right. So you wrote the book based on your experience with your one child. What about the choice that throughout the illustrations, it's not one protagonist? There's a lot of different kids. Was that always what you envisioned, or did that come about? Or
That was partly just a matter of practicality, in that the images that I used were friends of mine, of mine's kids, photographs that I worked from. So, you know, and that's often how I just work. And I was thinking, well, if I'm going to have one child that is throughout the story, I'm going to actually have to get a child model, you know, to really fix all those scenes. But if I just ask all my friends, like, to just, you know, and which is what we did, I just sent out an email and say, you know, I'm working on this book with Adam, and if you want your kid to be in the book called Go the Fuck to Sleep, send me some pictures. And it was like, yeah, just send some pictures of your kid just, like, kind of being a jerk, you know? Like.
But what's so great about it, that happy accident, is that part of what makes the book seem so fresh is that I don't really see that in a lot of kids' books, where there are a lot of different races represented, there are a lot of different kids represented, and it makes it feel very, very fresh and modern and not staid, or that's part of its genius, I think.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I've read some reviews where they call the illustration subversive. I've seen that a lot of times, and I'm touched by that. I'm tickled by that, but
why
I'm not
subversive?
Really
subversive. I don't get that either.
I'm not really sure either. Like the New York Times just did a piece, a really nice piece on the book, and call the illustrations subversive. I don't know.
Simply because
is it because there's it's mixed races.
I never
really
thought of that.
Sad.
Yeah,
I don't know
if that counts as subversive.
Right. I don't know. I was just curious.
Right, it's
about
an integrated children's book. Yeah, that's.
Or maybe they mean because you pull off the sweetness.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I would hope that's what they
maybe
mean.
It's the text and the pictures together that make it seem subversive.
Yeah. But I think that although it wasn't an issue of practicality, we also did want the book to be reflective of our own communities and the diversity therein. So I think that was part of the plan from the beginning also.
Sure, sure. Yeah. I mean, for example, I think like seeing Samuel Jackson as Jules, what's his name in Pulp Fiction?
Winfield.
Jules Winfield. I mean, there's a guy with a big Jerry curl in this children's book, and that you know, I haven't seen one that in a while.
No, you
know?
Yeah. You never see that.
You seldom see that. Yeah, maybe in L.A.
And that's both like a race thing and a class thing. Like you really don't see children's books unless the whole book is about. Mm-hmm. This is one of my big pet peeves about when children's books try and become inclusive. Mm-hmm. And I try to get my daughter like books with little brown kids in, but the brown kids can't have an adventure
because
the whole fucking book is about how I like the fact that I'm okay that I'm brown.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then you're at the end of the book and you never know if nothing happened.
Yeah.
And so I really hate that. But in the, you don't see books about poor kids or kids from different backgrounds unless the book is about I'm poor and from a different background and I'm going to be okay.
Right.
And it's really sad. And,
That's absolutely right. It's yet another reason I don't read children's books to my daughter.
No, I read that you're like she's like for real now. Like she's like reading chapter. I mean, she's like reading some classics.
I mean, I don't want to sit up here and I do want to sit up here and brag about my kid, but I'm not gonna do that. But we did have to ask Samuel L. Jackson's permission to use his likeness in this version, and he was he's been super cool throughout this whole process. And he immediately agreed and requested that he be given the original artwork and closed his email with the phrase, y'all some cool motherfuckers, which for me, that was like the pinnacle right there,
Right.
Like it was cool when the book hit number one and it was cool to get like parodied in The New Yorker and in Mad Magazine. But when Sam said that we were some cool motherfuckers, I was like,
did you guys approach him for the Audible thing or who came up with that genius
Audible,
idea?
Audible.com, who did the audiobook, approached him. But he was on our, they asked us for a list of people to read the audiobooks.
Then that was you guys, because I don't know that anybody would have naturally.
Yeah, it was an inspired choice. I don't remember, everything was moving so fast back then that I don't remember. I remember that we had Werner Herzog on the list, and he also ended up recording a version.
You had Christopher Walken.
Christopher Walken was on the list.
And
Sam was on the list. I feel like
I don't remember Sam being on the list. And I remember being surprised when it was mentioned of like, that's the most obvious choice. Like, can't believe.
It's kind of awesome.
Slick Rick was on my list. I remember
that's kind of awesome as well.
And they all happened very quickly. I mean, it was like Tuesday, Sam's going to do the book. Wednesday, Sam did the book. Again, it's a very short book.
And Thursday, do you want to come to Letterman? And Sam's going to be reading the book on Letterman tonight.
Right.
And I was like, yeah.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Are there more planned?
More
books. More of the kids' books.
Probably not, I mean, I won't say no because I may need some more money at some point, but I mean, I don't want to be the guy who beats it into the ground,
Right,
I was hesitant about doing the G-rated version because I didn't want to hit people over the head again and be that guy. The last thing I want to do is have people be sort of weary and sick of it and be like, yeah, Go the Fuck to Sleep was funny, but like Eat Your Fucking Vegetables was lame and like, I think, as soon as one of the things I had to do, I mean, there's this very intense and prolonged, protracted period of doing tons and tons of media, which was great. I mean, again, as a writer of literary fiction, you're happy if somebody interviews you on like, their blog or whatever, you'll do anything. But I mean, I ended up doing so much, and one of the things that I had to do repeatedly were these radio tours. I don't know if anybody here has done a radio tour, but you don't actually get to go on tour. The tour comes to you. You sit in a room with a microphone, and every 10 minutes, a different radio station calls you. And it was depressing because, it's like, okay, next is Omaha. Boom, you do 10 minutes with Omaha. Miami, San Francisco, Kansas City. And it's the same show. And you realize that every morning show in this country is the same show, and the host is the same guy, and he's like a jocular jackass, and, you know, he's got like a female sidekick whose job is to pretend that like the sexist shit he says is funny, and then he's got another sidekick with a comical name, like, you know, Booger or whatever, and, you know, and that guy would always ask me, like, do you have any other books? And then, and I wouldn't even answer. I'd be like, because I knew what was coming. It was because I got some suggestions of my own. And then you'd hear like his three unfunny suggestions, and you'd have to pretend that they were funny and laugh at them and be like, ha, 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 you know. And sometimes they'd be really over there. I fucking hate you, and I want to throw you off a bridge. And I'm like, yeah, dude, I didn't say all that. I love my daughter, you know. So I think by the end of that, I mean, I sort of had a, I don't know. The radio tours were tricky because it just like, man, this country is so
weird,
dumb, you know.
Yeah.
But also the notion of doing a sequel was deadened for me by the numerous radio host attempts to be funny with sequel titles.
And I think also for a writer, I've heard this from other people. This is not my experience, but who have this kind of tremendous success and have to go around all over the place, it disconnects you from the thing that you most want to be doing, which is writing.
Playing.
Because it's
sorry. You were going to say writing. Sorry.
I was going to say writing.
I didn't even finish what I was going to say.
But, you know, I would think that it's an embarrassment of riches that you're not able, you know, you're disconnected from your family when you travel. Yeah. You can't write. And what do you have planned? What do you have coming up, Ricardo?
What am I doing? I just finished a book. I've done a lot of children's books, but as you mentioned, they're kind of weird too. And I think that's why Adam found me in the first place. I did a kid's book about marijuana, drug policy, terrorism. And I just did a book.
Wait.
Those are different books. It's not about marijuana and terrorism.
But all for kids. But all for kids.
Those are for children,
okay,
yeah.
Okay.
It's just a plan. Ricardo, if I may just endorse this book quickly. It's a really wonderful book, and it's not suggesting that you let your kid smoke weed or anything.
Sure.
It's just about a responsible conversation
about
the subject.
It's about a child who finds out her parents are smoking marijuana, like happens
where
across
is this
the
book?
Country. The book is called It's Just a Plant, and it's out there. You can find it online, Just a Plant.
Yeah. You got to know the right people if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I like to do books that talk about complex issues and break them down into simple language. And drug policy is something that I've always been interested in, and somehow I realized that drug policy can be relevant to a children's life because their parents can be incarcerated you know, so it's not so distant.
Well, what's kind of awesome about that is you're not politicizing kids, but you're introducing them to at an early age to how laws affect people's lives, and that's kind of awesome.
Yeah, that's and about conversations that are relevant to them. That, you know, if I mean, I had friends that at 9 years old found some marijuana in their parents' drawer and went to call the police on their parents, you know, because they had been grown up and learned about that.
Yeah.
You know,
no, I was one of those nerdy kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was a dare officer.
I didn't turn in my parents; I turned in my sister.
Uh huh.
Big time turned in my sister. No, because
relationship
they used to
never really recovers from that.
No,
does it?
We're okay now. But I mean, you remember they used to show you those film strips? Remember the film strips? And you know, everybody would be laid out by the toilet with a needle out of their arm. Right. And so when I heard on the bus that she was, you know. I went to my mom weeping that my sister was going to die, and we had to do something about it. So I needed your book in 1980, whenever that was. Anyway, we have time for some questions, so I don't know if there are people here that want to ask questions of Adam and Ricardo. Oh, and Jenna, come join us. I remember that was part of our...
Yeah.
How fast, I mean, what I remember reading was that, you know, about the backlash to the book initially, that people had no sense of humor about it at all. So my question is, how fast did it morph from the original book into the notion of making a version targeted at kids? And part two is, can we hear something from the original version?
I think it was a number of months, I think, before we started thinking about the G-rated version, and it definitely wasn't a response to the backlash, because while there was a backlash, it didn't really have any adverse effect on us. It was mostly, I think, funny and drove interest. You know, like I mentioned the New Zealand thing before. There was a group called Family First New Zealand, and you know they tried to get the book banned, and their press release was like, you know, in the hands of normal, well-adjusted parents, this book is harmless and even funny. Okay, so far so good. But in the hands of aggressive, dysfunctional parents, it could pose a real risk to children.
Yeah, because you know, the book is the problem. If you have a violent, difficult parent, it's the book that's really good.
Right, right. In the hands
kid.
Of aggressive, dysfunctional parents, like a spoon is, you know, danger to children. So it was. I think it came some months later. You know, and Ricardo had brilliantly done the illustrations at this larger size, so that we were able to do it at a larger kids' book type of size.
Yeah. And it was even fun as the illustrator to finally get to see it like at a full size, you know. But and I think now there's almost a backlash against this because there's a lot of people. Well, originally we're confused, like we're like, oh, I can't believe you censored the book.
And right.
It's like no, that one's still out there.
Right.
It hasn't
again,
been shut down.
Perplexing. Like yeah, we belatedly became indignant and disgusted by our own book and have decided to pull it out of the market. Like really. I can probably, I mean, when Jenna was reading it, I was replacing the, mentally replacing the
so
curses anyway. Yeah, it's hard to read it with. I guess I could read a little bit of. Oh, okay, that's even better. I can do a couple. I mean, I'm no Sam Jackson or Jenna Elfman. Maybe Jenna should read it.
Well, she's you're the one who says fuck every other word. Like
yeah,
me.
That's true.
I did a music video.
Yeah, yeah.
Me and my friend Nika Costa, who's a funk, hip, you know, soul singer, were inspired by Go the Fuck to Sleep because we're both parents and we've both spent hours in the bedroom ourselves. And she has a YouTube channel, and we were trying to figure out something to do together for her YouTube channel. She's like, "What about this book, Go the Fuck to Sleep? Let's do something with that." And I was like, "What should we do? What should we?" I went, "Oh my God, Nika, you have to turn it into a hip hop song." And so she did. Same, all the same lyrics, but turned it into a hip hop. Went in the studio, recorded it, and then we made a music video for this rap song, and put it up on her YouTube channel, hoping not to get sued by him.
Right.
And we didn't really ask
my lawyers
permission.
Are still weighing the matter. Yeah,
this is my making amends, you know. But then they reached out to us because they got on their radar and. And so now I've been doing fun little things, and they're going to include the video in the ebook.
Yeah, the video is amazing. You guys should watch the video. Here's a couple. I'll do a stand. The eagles who soar through the sky are at rest, and the creatures who crawl, run, and creep. I know you're not thirsty. That's bullshit. Stop lying. Lie the fuck down, my darling, and sleep. It's a taste of
what it's so true. It's so true.
You'll get your book back.
Hi. As someone whose memories of the 1950s are crystal clear, and someone who is the mother of a 27, 25-year-old, wow. I wish this book had been around when I was trying to get my son to go the fuck to sleep. I also wish Dr. Ferber had been around, because that's actually what we ended up doing.
Me
but
too.
Do
too.
I understand you that as a result of your daughter's sleeping difficulties, you chose not to have a second child?
No.
Oh.
No.
So do you have or plan to have a second child? Because I'd like to encourage you to try
you
again. Sometimes you get lucky with the second one.
Well, I mean, I got lucky with the first one. I mean, she's great, you know. Another reason that I feel no urge to write additional books is because with the exception of not sleeping promptly, my daughter is wonderful. Like, she doesn't do anything else that infuriates me to the point of wanting to bang my head against the wall. So I, you know, but yeah, I'm open to the possibility
of. Give it a couple of years.
Yeah, all right. I'm open to the possibility of further children. You can tell my mom that we're working on it. We're in negotiations.
Is that all? Well, I do have to, as a board member of the Library Foundation, encourage you guys one more time to consider becoming members. Not only does it help fund incredible programs like this, but there also we have concerts and parties here at the library. You can join Young Literati and do some of their really kind of incredible events. So I really encourage you to consider membership. It's a special foundation.
Me too. The mugs are also really nice.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.